Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein here in the Yeshiva Shalmaila. Our next two segments will be about kosher food. And in particular, we'll be speaking about foie gras and veal, tzar balachayim, the issa d'oraisa of tzar balachayim, and food that gets a hechsher, even though it's possibly the product of tzar balachayim. We'll be speaking to Rabbi Elephant, who's the head of kashrus for the OU. We will be speaking to Paul Shapiro of the Humane Society of the United States. We will be speaking to the owners of Grow and Behold, an organization that that actually raises beef and other animals that in a way that there is no. We'll be speaking about it both from halacha and hashkafic manner. Next week, we will be speaking about vegetarianism and halacha. Question we got from somebody in India: can you eat in a vegan restaurant that does not have a heksha? And we will have on a very interesting array of rabbanim, of kashrus professionals. Before we go to our guests, I would like to say a vart about the parsha. One of the highest fillers of the year on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is when the chazan says, HaMelech. And what is it? And if you look in the Oseus of HaMelech in a good machsa, it makes Oseus Yitzchak and Rivka, right? We actually say it every tefillah, but b'fi yisharim tisraimim. And the question is, why at this high moment do we talk about Yitzchak and Rivka? And to my knowledge, and if somebody in the audience has another makar, please send it to me, no place else in a tefillah is a sort of merumiz, the marriage of one of the avos. Right? So I think it's not a big horror, but it's something to think about. And I have a political Torah. Who's the first child at risk, the first Jewish child at risk? Is Esav. The Gemara in Kedushin and Daf Yud Ches calls him a Yisrael Mumarashi, or the Rishonim say that he was Magayer, his wives. He considered himself a Yisrael. He got Yerusha like a Yisrael, etc. He's called the Yisrael Mumar, the child, the Yisrael who went off. Here's what's interesting. Yitzchak, even though in the beginning it says he fooled him, right? But ultimately, you have to believe that Yitzchak found out. And what are some of the rayas? I'll give you a few rayas. One, it says, Yitzchak becomes blind from the incense of the wives of Esav who are being makriv l'avodah zarah. So Yitzchak's Esav is bringing these women to his house. I imagine these women were not, if they were Avdei Avodah Zarah in his house, were probably not dressed so tznias dik, probably didn't say the nicest things. I mean, we can all recognize an Avedes Avodah Zarah versus a Beis Yaakov girl, right? And in his house, Yitzchak says, what's all this smoke? The smoke? It's to the Baal. It's to pick your favorite Avodah Zarah, right? He never says a word. Never says a word. Rivka never says a word. Later on in the parsha, it says Esav comes in. It says Vayechrad Yitzchak Harada Gadol Ad Moed. Rash says why? Because the mouth of Gehenim opened up, and what does he do? And he blesses him. And later on, they know they have Rivka for sure knows she has two terrible. She has one terrible child, and one. What does she do? She sends away Yaakov, and she keeps the child at risk at home. Rivka recognizes, as does Yitzchak, that what? That the child at risk may need parents much more than the other child, the good child. So here's a beautiful Torah from Reb Meir Primishlana. He says, Vayehav Yitzchak es Esav ki tzayid b'siv. He captured him with his mouth. He entrapped him. So Reb Meir Primishlana says, the Gemara says in Shabbos, it says at the end of time, I think it's Peites, in that zip code, the Gemara says at the end of time, Klal Yisrael, Rabbi Yisrael is going to come to Klal Yisrael, to the Avos, and he says, Banecha Chatu. He says, there's a 70% intermarriage today. Banecha Chatu. And what is Avram going to say? Yimachal al Kiddush Mecha. And Yaakov says, Yimachal al Kiddush Mecha. And the Washington Gemara, I think, is, Loi b'sabi taimei v'loi b'daradik emilsei. So they go to Yitzchak and just says, save them. No! Yitzchak stands up for them. So Reb Meir Primishlana says, you know what he tells Rabbi Nishalom? He says, when I had a child at risk in my house, he was over the Avodah Zarah. He made me blind. His wives made my life miserable. Did I send him away? I never sent the child at risk away. I sent Yaakov away. So he says, what does the Rabbeinu Shalom answer? He has no answer to that. He has no response. So he says, Vayev Yitzchak es Esav Rameo Primishlana says, Kitzayid Befiv. He was able to capture, entrap Kaviyachal because of Esav. That's what it means, Kitzayid. But he knew that Esav would be the answer to any taina the Rabbeinu Shalom Kaviyachal could have in the future against Klal Yisrael. You have a child who's at risk? Look what Yitzchak did. Look what Rivka did. Here's a vart. Let me share with you a beautiful Torah from the Chiddush Erim. He says the brachas that Klal Yisrael got were when Yaakov was dressed in the garb of Esav. Right? He was dressed Ula Yemusheni Yavi. Why did that have to happen? So he says, because inside, somehow, high knew, Rivka knew, that there would come a time that there would be children who look like Esav. There are children who would murder. There were children that would steal. There were children that would be over the Avodah Zarah, that they would do drugs, and they would become, have Shilas and Emunah. They would become atheists. He knew that there were children who would look like Esav, children of Klal Yisrael, the Yisrael Mummer. And what did she say? She said, these children have to be blessed too. So the brachas that Klal Yisrael got were when Yaakov was wearing Big Day Esav. So let me share with you something pretty controversial. The Baal Seder Hadoris. Seder Hadoris is a Mekubal Dika Sefer 400 years ago, one of the earliest history Sefer practically that we have. And he was Makbid. The Seder Hadoris has the biggest Haskamas in the world. He brings from the Shalshelis HaKabbalah. And this is, I'll put it on our website. It's in the Elef HaChamishi Shin Mem Aleph. He's writing about the Rambam. He says that he, Ra'isi Bekuntras Yashin, I found in an ancient booklet. He says that Maimon, the father of the Rambam, was a great scholar. He probably learned Yomim V'Layla. He never wanted to get married. He said one night he had a dream and an ish came to him and he said, marry the daughter of a certain butcher, was not Lafik Faidai. And he ignored the dream. And the dream happened again and again and again. And he said, it's Min HaShemayim. And he married the daughter of that butcher. And they had a child. And he says, she died at childbirth. And they named the child, he named the child Moshe. And he said, the child was a difficult child. He was an orphan. So Rav Maimon married again. I guess he hoped the new stepmother would make his life better, and it didn't. He had more children, and the child did not get along with the stepmother and the other children. And he says, and it created great conflict in the family. The child didn't learn. He was a child at risk. Vayagarsheyu mibesai. And Maimon, he chased him from the house, and he went to the city of the Rimigash, this child, and he became enamored with the great Rimigash. And he became, who did this child become? He became the Rambam. And he writes about how he came back years later to the city of Rav Maimon, and he spoke in Shul, and they were all incredible. What a great person he had become. He says, the Rambam was a child at risk. How do we deal with children at risk? Do we hit them? Do we strike them? Do we yell at them? Or do we do like Yitzhak and Rivka? So let me tell you, there's a Gemara in Baba Metzia and Daf Pehei. The Gemara says that Rebbe came to a town where Rebbe Elazar Reb Shimon, the son of Reb Shimon Bar Yochai, the author of the Zohar, lived. And he said, Hey, Yesh Ben Lo'isei Tzadik. Does Rebbe Elazar Reb Shimon have a son? So they said, yes, sadly, he has a son. And every prostitute in town is enamored with his son. So Rebbe was shaken, and he said, bring him to me. So they brought him. And it says, Rebbe put his hands on him, and he says, I am making you, I'm giving you smicha, I'm calling you a Rebbe. And the Gemara talks about how he ultimately became a big Rebbe. He became, what did he do? He didn't insult him, he called him Rebbe. And the Gemara says another story, where Rebbe came to the town of Reptarfin, and he says, does Reptarfin have a son? And he says, he has a grandson. And he cavorts with prostitutes all day. Talking about bad, bad things, right? That probably the children at risk, most of the children, aren't known as the hero of the prostitutes, right? And what did he do with him? Similar thing. He brought him and he said, if you do tshuva, I'll grant you the greatest honor if you start studying. How did he deal with him? Sagveinu tareinu naira, with respect. If you respect them, Rebbe says, something good will come of it. So I tell you that it's some of the holiest tefillos of the year when we say Hamelech and Rosh Hashanah, when we say Hamelech, and when we come in front of the king, who do we mention? We mention Rivka and Yitzchak, and we say, they had children at risk, Rabbi Nishalem. Esav, as bad as I was this year, wasn't as bad as Esav, the Yisrael Mummer. And how did they deal with him? They loved him. They kept him. They sent Yaakov away. Rabbi Nishalem, do the same with us. And I know that everybody has some child or knows a child who's maybe not exactly what they want. Are they the hero of the prostitutes? I doubt they're that bad. Are they like Esav with a makrav of a desar in the house? I doubt it. And what do? We say, Ma'aseh Avei Sim L'Banim. The Torah teaches us how we are supposed to treat children, deal with children who maybe aren't exactly, or maybe more than exactly, the way we would have liked them to be. So what do I say? Habitu El Avram Avichem. Let's to be Zeichel. We should do Ma'aseh Avei Sim L'Banim from this week's Parsha. See how Yitzhak and Rivka dealt with children who are the antithesis, a child antithesis of everything they believed in. Let's learn from that. Let's go to our wonderful guests. We have a fabulous program, 2 weeks about food. We have the honor of having on the phone with us Harav Moshe Elephant, who besides having the largest Daf Yomi Shir in the world, is also the head of Kashrus for the OU. Welcome, Rabbi Elephant.
Aleichem Shalom, Rabbi Lichtenstein.
So, Rabbi Elephant, the OU is about to give a heksha on the first foie gras, kosher foie gras. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
I think it's four, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
French.
Yeah, I didn't do well at French in Yeshiva B'nai Torah. They actually didn't have any foreign language. I think it was Hebrew or Yiddish.
I don't know French either. We have something in common.
So, it's the first heksha given in America on foie gras. And I'd like to discuss it with you.
Okay.
Foie gras is a little bit controversial. And let me just tell our Olam, is because there are a number of problems. One of them is that when they force feed it, it often makes a nekev in the vesht, in the esophagus, which is one of the yud ches treifis. So that's historically it's been a problem, and I think most of Hasidim didn't use it. I believe in Russia it wasn't so used. Har Tzvi says in Eretz Yisrael it wasn't used. The Chasam Sofer was matir it. Additionally, there are other kashrus problems which we'll get into. So my question to you would be, why would the OU want to be machshir something as controversial as this?
So the answer is a number of levels. First of all, as you just said, it's a product that was used in certain communities. Certainly in Oberland, where the Chasam Sofer's Minhagim were followed, it was a very popular product. Moreover, in Paris and France, it's like a basic food product. You go into any kosher restaurant in Paris, and there are many, there may be up to 120 kosher restaurants, I understand, in Paris. There's one thing you'll find on the menu of every one of them, and that's foie gras. It's like a basic food item. And we here at the OU have actually received numerous requests over the years from different people that are very, very anxious to have kosher foie gras. So it's a product that there is a real demand for. And, of course, we never tell anybody that they're obligated to eat any OU product. As I've said myself in different interviews about this product, I don't believe that I'll eat foie gras because I come from a family that followed Sanzer Menhagim. And as you correctly said a few minutes ago, in the Chassidische Welt, it was very not accepted to eat foie gras. My father told us that where he came from, they never ate it. So I certainly won't eat gestopt. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't make it available for those who do want to eat it.
Okay, so Rabbi Elephant, let me continue along this fact. It's known that the Bach was one of the first who asserted it. The Taz in I think it's Lamed Gimel, brings the Bach. And the Shach and the Nekudas HaKesef, the Shvus Yankiv in Hungary, the Maramash,
the Devar Chaim in Galitzmaya, the Yismach Moishev, obviously of Hungary, the Eshel Avram, not the Bechacha, but the Eshel Avram, Rav Broida, the Darke Tshuva, the Sigita, as late as the Tzitz Eliezer, I believe even the Chazenish. So my question to you is, given the controversy around it, will the OU, just like it has, like on some things, dairy equipment, will they put a flag on it, you know, this, or will they just do it as kosher?
No, we certainly won't put a flag on it, la'ichle gestop. Because just like, and the answer is because we hold our pidin, it's kosher. I really also have to add a very, very important element, and that is that the gestopt that you see today in the store is not the gestopt that the Devar Chaim saw. And the reason is primarily because one of the big concerns, as you mentioned earlier, is that the feeding will cause an akuva saveshet that will cause the esophagus to tear. In those days, the way they made gestopt is that they fed the bird the animal feed, which is corn or wheat or whatever, which is sharp or could be sharp and could cause that kind of a perforation. We don't have that today. The water, the feed that these birds are getting is extremely liquefied, and therefore the percentage of nekuvas haveshet drops dramatically, and that concern that the old Paiska mentioned, and of course, it's very hard to take that type of an approach, because if you can take that type of approach, it's a very slippery slope, but it's not the same as what they were talking about.
Okay, so first of all, Rabbi Elephant, I applaud the OU for, you know, like the Rashi always says, koyach te teira adif, instead of just throwing a blanket at it, saying, look, we are going to be machshirit, according to the Chassam Sofer, etc. I think it's, you know, the children today grow up, everything is us, sir. I think somebody having that, but notwithstanding, I think it's still worthwhile having this conversation.
No, I'm very anxious to have this conversation, and I'm certainly not telling anybody, because I'm not telling it to myself, to eat this product. And I recognize why people may not want to eat this product. I'm just saying to you that it may be different than what it was.
So let me respond, Rabbi. Let me ask the following question. I've gone online and I saw how they do it, and they put a pipe, I would guess it's around a 10-inch pipe. They grab the goose or the duck
the birds that we're doing are ducks.
Are ducks, and they put it. They insert this foot pipe into, and it goes right into the stomach, into the crop actually. And it pumps this liquid in. Now, when they pull out the pipe, you often see blood on the pipe because a duck's neck is not straight. It, you know, it curves. And when they jam it in and they do something like 30 an hour, a minute, it's whatchamacallit. It comes out bloody, which certainly would say, notwithstanding the fact that there's no shayla of a kites probably in the liquefied product, but you could have a neck of a vesht with a pipe too. Now, what's interesting is that if you look at many of the Paiskim who are Machmir, let's say the Bnei Sasra, or as recently as the Tzitz Eliezer, he says, let me see if I could find the language, but he says something to this, like, the Ein Adam Hayoim Sheyachel Lahayez Shebaki Bebedikas Havesht. He says, there's nobody today who could claim on himself that he's a Baki as to what is called a perforation. Well, here's his exact. Ein moira herosh yachal lahagiz daite v'lahay dalatzbek yunu baki bibedikas haveshet. So once you're doing a procedure where a pipe is going down and comes out often bloody, how could we? What do you do with this shaila? How do we know this?
Let me respond to that. And of course, I don't have the chutzpah to argue with the Tzitz Eliezer. About 15 minutes ago, I just looked at a tshuva Tzitz Eliezer.
And it's as well as the Bnei Yisuf. He's not the first. Many have said the same thing.
But I have to tell you that in the communities where they ate gestopt, there were people who were mavinim in checking the vesht. Rabelski Zatzal, I mean, this is a project that's been developed at the OU. It took years till we got to this point. Rabelski Zatzal was very involved and gave us hadracha, how to check the vesht. I spoke just today, Mamish Min HaShemayim, that I just spoke today to the Rav who came from Eretz Yisrael, who is an expert in this field. He already worked in Hungary where they were shechting these types of ducks and geese. He's worked in Eretz Yisrael. Currently, there are not any factories in Eretz Yisrael that are making this product, but there was a time when there were, and he was very involved with that production. And this is a person who's amazing, and we brought him in specially to check and work on making sure that we know how to check those veshtas. And, of course, if there's any slight shaila, we right away reject that veshtas.
But there are many paiskim, like the Darkei Tshuva says the same thing.
That's
he says,
right. And I agree. But I'll tell you, when I came to the OU 30 years ago, there was a factory in Eretz Yisrael in Petach Tikva that was doing this product. And Rav Osner himself was very involved in how to check the veshtas and gave our mashgichim the direction of how to do it. Now, I understand that these Gedolei Yisrael, who I will never take the chutzpah of arguing with, felt you can't check. But again, the point I'm trying to make is that this is a old shaila, and there were those that said that they know how to do it and taught us how to do it. And I understand that those that felt this is too challenging and don't even start.
Okay, so let me give you another iteration then of the question I asked you before. We had the honor of having you at the OU many times here on our program. And I asked them a question once. I said, why are you machmir? Could you eat? What can you eat in a grocery that does not have a hechshel? Like, could I buy a can of peas or corn? And the answer was no. We give an OU on all these products because they're cooked in these huge vats. And, you know, the cans are inserted into a vat with a lot of hot water. And who knows, maybe an hour before that in the same vat, they cooked pork and beans. And my response was, I said, look, you have a suffix of maybe it was there, maybe it wasn't. So it's one suffix. You have a suffix. Maybe it's batel b'shishim. You have a suffix of nice and tam lefgam. You have a suffix of einu b'nei yayman. You have a suffix of shefa. Many sfeikis, sfeika, which for sure would be mutter. And the response was that here at the OU, we just want to do things right, and we don't want to be nichnas and sfeikis. I mean, you could theoretically wash in the same dishwasher, milchige and fleischige dishes, and say, look, you know, you have this suffix and the other suffix. And we say, look, we don't want to do it that way. So being that the OU is so machmir and does not want to be nichnas into sfeikis, which are sfeika, why here would they say we want to be nichnas into what? A lot of paiskim. And I'll read you the language of the B'nai Yisachar. It says, harei havi kibay basar nevela. Why would you want to be nichnas into that suffix?
Okay, so I'm going to be a big boy and admit that the conversation you're referring to is a conversation you had with me. I'm going to try to tell you why this is a very different situation. When we had the conversation about the canned vegetables, and we had a debate, should you look for a product with a hechsher, or should you not have a product with a hechsher? And again, I don't remember the exact wording of our conversation, but essentially my point was that there are vegetables, canned vegetables, available with a reliable hashgacha. And you're right. I mean, you're a Talmud Chacham. You're right. You have all these fakers, and maybe Al Pidin, after you have all these fakers, you're allowed to have those vegetables. But why get into these fakers when you could have right next to you on the same shelf a canned vegetable that has a very reliable hashgacha, and don't get into any shaylos? Any foie gras, it's not that the foie gras that we're certifying, you could tell me, Rabbi Elephant, you could do it better. And therefore, why you're not doing it better? Because if you could tell me what you think we should be doing better on the foie gras, I do it. You're just saying, don't do it at all. And my response to you is, well, we're here to service people who want it. And when, you know, many years ago, Rabbi Ganak and I were asked to meet the Belzer Rebbe when he was here in America the last time. I've said the story many times. And the Belzer Rebbe greeted us very warmly, and he told us he's heard what a wonderful Hashgacha agency the OU is, and he holds that the time has come for the OU to start being Makban and Kol Yisrael. And we answered him, the OU is not just here for people here in Brooklyn or Manhattan or New York, where Chol Yisrael is so readily available. We're here to service people where Chol Yisrael is not readily available. And if we're not going to give them Kol Stam product, they're going to buy non-kosher product. The point I'm making to you is that there are a lot of people, whether, I don't know where they come from, whether they came from Oberland or they come from France or they Stam, don't know about the Shilas like you do know about them, that are interested in foie gras. And it's our job as a reliable Hashgacha agency to make those products available to them as long as there are Gedolei Yisrael that stood behind the product, and we're not telling anybody to eat it.
I think, Rabbi Elephant, I think that's a fantastic answer, and I accept it. I would like to ask you another question. The many Paiskim hold that if you have a Chumrah or Hanhaga, that's a psak from your Rav, and I have a different psak, and I feed you something that according to your Rav is not kosher or wouldn't be mutter, I'm over lifnei iver deraisa. And it wouldn't, even if it's a chumrah drabon, and Aspen Darai says it's lifnei iver deraisa, because if you put a stone in somebody and he falls, just tripping somebody is lifnei iver. So if I trip somebody in a drabon, and he says that's the equivalent of putting a stone there. So if you have somebody, you're going to put out this product, and you're going to have a bab of a chassid go to the thing, and he's says, you know, we're marrying off our Rezala. Let's do something mamish special for her. It's such a simcha. We had a bris, whatever, and we're going to serve foie gras. Now, this guy doesn't know anything about foie gras. He never knew the Sanzarov screamed on it. You know, his lashon is, I think the lashon of the thing is, whoever could be mevatel this on from Klal Yisrael, it's lashon abach, tovaya lebracha, and he's going to serve this foie gras. And he's, Babov comes from Sanz, whichever number you are, Babov, you still come from Sanz. Mm-hmm. And his father came from Sanz, his Zayda came from Sanz, and this guy, according to the minig of his chassidus, is mamash eating a nevela. So would the OU have a din of being machshel people and being oivalif ne'iver, and based on that halachic premise, would you be allowed to do it?
It's a good question, so I'll tell you. To use the same comparison I used a moment ago, and I know you may not agree with what I'm going to say, but let's talk about Chol Yisrael versus Chol Stam. In certain kreisen, in certain groups, particularly in Lubavitch, non-Chol Yisrael was considered extremely problematic. I know that we at the OU get numerous calls, with a kalim that we have even a parv product that was manufactured on a dairy line, kashered with 212. Some of the people who call don't even know what that means, but they know to ask the question. So does that mean that we at the OU have an obligation to write on the product at what temperature was kashered? Or does it mean that when you ask the Rav Shaila, he gives you a psak? And if you want to know the basis of the psak, you should ask him for the basis of the psak. But most people want to know kosher treif mutar aser. We can't put out a shtickle Torah on every product we certify.
Ramesha, anybody who gives the biggest afyayim share in the world has to be preceded with a reb. To me,
okay.
It's another pashut. So I have two points that I would counter to that. And one is that most people are versed in Chol of Yisrael. I mean, your house is either makban on Chol of Yisrael or not makban on Chol of Yisrael. And those that are know that there's the brands that are very makbid, and they know that those that aren't, and it's not the Hamish brands, Ungers, Hadar, etc., not, I think most people would not be nichshel. I think your average person, even if he's not an Amaretz, even if he went to yeshiva, would not know the issues of Gestaptigens. So it's far more likely here. It's a suffix she'enim matzi, a miyud she'enim matzi, and here I'm not even sure it's a miyud. It could be a roiv hamatzi that wouldn't have a clue, and therefore I would ask a rav if I gave a hechsher and this am I oivalif na'iver? That to me is a very big difference with Chol of Yisrael.
I hear what you're saying, and I'm certainly not discounting what you're saying. I think that for most of the people. And I want to say this very, very carefully. I would say most of the people who care and want to be makbid and won't use foie gras because of the various minhagim or shilas that you correctly identified are aware of it. And the people who aren't so well-versed are people that Baruch Hashem were serving them kosher for grah, and worrying about lifnei iver is much less of a concern. I just gave a shiur this past Shabbos. I'm sure you've discussed this in some of your radio programs, and that is, you know, when you invite a non-religious person to your house on Shabbos for a meal, and he's going to drive, are you over lifnei iver or misayaya? Or on the other hand, maybe you're doing the right thing by being makar of him. And there are many poskim, it's a big machloikus, it's not the subject, but told that you have to look at the big picture. And the big picture is you're being makar of him. And that's the point I'm trying to make here. The big picture is that we're bringing kosher for grah to people that if we didn't have kosher for grah, chas v'shalom.
Yeah, but you could do both by putting a note on it and saying it's like...
I want to tell you about notes.
Right.
I want to tell you something about notes. I can't tell you how many times in my career I've been asked by people, because this is very commonly asked questions, what bracha do you make on this cereal and that cereal? And the OU and other hashgachas have on their websites and in other ways publicized what brachas you make on different cereals. And people tell me, why don't you just put the bracha on the cereal? Just have the bracha put on the cereal and it'll make it easier and it'll be a real service to Klal Yisrael. The answer is we're living in Golis. And we're Baruch Hashem, fortunate that companies are willing to put the OU on the product. And they're not willing to put brachas. They're not willing to put on shtiklich Torah. So going and telling a person who's making a product, well, if you're going to want OU certification, it's going to have to come with a shtiklich Torah. Ayin Bach, v'ayin chsam soifer, v'ayin. That's not what's happening in the real world of business.
Okay. Now... many other Paiskim, I shouldn't say many, but a number of other Paiskim, again, the Eshel Avram, the Bnei Yisascha, the Tzitzel Yezer, say, notwithstanding the Shaila of Nikuv Avesht, which you say by liquefying the food is less problematic, there is another problem in that the liver gets so engorged, it becomes something like 6 or 8 times its normal size, that after this 3-week period, when they stuff it, the animal could not live anymore. The bird would not be able to, and becomes a trefa. So how would you deal with the issa, forget about Nikuv Avesht, of this concept of trefa that these pies can bring up?
So first of all, I don't think that's one of the Yudches trefas. So I'm not sure that we can identify a new trefa just because they're saying it could not survive the year of, you know, which is always the shear by a trefa. I'm not sure that many places can hold that there are Yudches Treifus, and just like if a doctor came to you today and told you that one of the Yudches Treifus is not an issue, Chas v'Shalom, we would never accept that, because we follow according to what Chazal taught us. It goes in two ways. So our position is that it's not one of the Yudches Treifus, and it's not clear from what I've discussed with the experts that is in fact even a fact that it cannot survive.
Okay. I mean, I'm mentioning some pretty big paiskim who say not that.
Okay. Again, there's no shaila that they're paiskim that answered it. We're not debating.
No, but not. I'm not talking about Nikov. I'm saying okay.
It's a machloikus. The same way that
okay.
Machloikus.
Now, what about how do you deal with the issue of tzar belachayim? You know, Ramesh has a famous tshuva that we a yuri shemayim should not eat veal because of tzar belachayim. How do you deal with that?
Okay, so that's a great question. And that's a question that we're asked, you know, on a lot of issues that involve Shechita. And there are a lot of people out there, and I don't say it in a negative way, who are very concerned about Tzar Baal Chaim. So I want to tell you what we at the OU are not. We at the OU are not experts in Tzar Baal Chaim. We don't claim to be experts in that field, and we're not. Just like we're not experts in food safety, and we're not experts in food poisoning. We're experts, hopefully, in kashrus. And as long as this product was not legal in the United States because of the Tzar Baal Chaim concerns, no one at the OU would ever, ever consider certifying such a product. But what has happened is that this plant is USDA monitored. It's not just that some person opened up the plant and making foie gras without government intervention. There's very serious government intervention in every step of the process. And they feel that there is no Tzar Baal Chaim issue, And I know that there are governments, as I told you earlier in our conversation, when I came to the OU, Israel allowed the production of foie gras. Israel does not allow the production of foie gras anymore because of Tzar Bal Chaim issues. In the United States, for many years, foie gras was not produced because the government was concerned with animal welfare issues. But now the government has changed its position based on what's happening, a lot to do with the liquefied food, a lot to do with the pipe that's used. And because the government has changed its concern and said that there's no Tzar Bal Chaim issue, we defer to their decision because they're the experts in Tzar Bal Chaim. We are not.
Okay, so Rabbi Ellison, let me respond. California, for example, is one of the few states that does offer it, that doesn't allow it because of Tzar Bal Chaim. But the Animal Welfare Act, here's why the USDA will not get involved, and I got this off of Wikipedia. The Animal Welfare Act excludes farm animals. So the Animal Welfare Act, which was enacted, says, I guess because of heavy lobbying, I don't know who was on, I imagine the farms, they have now excluded all birds, rats, because that's what they do for medical research. I guess that was the medical lobby. Laboratory mice and all farm animals are now excluded from the Animal Welfare Act. And therefore, the government doesn't opine. So you could do whatever you want to that duck or goose. And the government is, at this point, except for California, going to say it doesn't fall under our jurisdiction. So given that the government has stopped opining on Tzar Bal Chaim, and the only state that does opine on it is California, and they do assert it, and they were just challenged in court. They said, how could you assert it if the government says you're not allowed to opine anymore? But there really is nobody who's overseeing animal cruelty, and you could do whatever you want to the animals, and they won't do anything. So based upon that, and based upon the fact that we have states and countries that don't allow it because of Tzar Bal Chaim, shouldn't we, who see that from Prika Tina, there's many riots. Shouldn't that be part of the equation here?
It very, very much is. And again, as I said, there are many people. And again, I don't believe that the government, and I haven't read up probably as much as you have, but I don't believe that the government is saying that, yes, these birds are suffering, but we can't say anything because of a lobby.
They don't opine to it. It says, I'll read the exact language. This is from Wikipedia. Excluded from the act are birds, rats of the genus Rattus, i.e. laboratory rats, mice of the genus Mus, laboratory mice, farm animals, and all cold-blooded animals, which means fish.
Okay. When we spoke to the various people who were involved, it sounded to us, and I know this for a fact, that there is still government watching on the Tzar Bal Chaim issue. So I'm not arguing what you read. I'm telling you what's happening in the farm, and I'm telling you what's happening in the slaughterhouse. They are watching, and they are making sure that it's done in the most humane way possible.
Okay. Rabbi Elephant, the Tzlach, the Noi de Behuda, writes that he brings all the problems with Gestaptigens. And he writes, and we'll put it on our website, it's in the Tzlach and Drosh Dalet, he says that really it's you shouldn't be matarit, but it's a gzeira she'ed hatzibur yachel lamidba. And based upon that, he says, it's therefore, he says, the only thing that it should be mutter for is geese, because since it's a heter, it's a heter. But chas v'shalom, he says, to extend this heter to any other genus of animal. Now, I understand one of the breakthroughs of this farm is they discovered that not only could you stuff geese, but you could also force-feed ducks as well. Would you be concerned that based upon the Tzlach, who says that the heter is, that it was given for one type of animal and for no other, and they're doing it for a new type of creature, that even according to the Matirim, it would be usher in this case?
So I spoke today to the Rav who's involved in that facility. And he told me two things. Number one, he said that this is not the first time that they've been doing duck. That when he was in Hungary, where they were doing this process, they were also doing ducks. So apparently there is a minig to already do duck and not strictly geese. And number two, he told me that there's minimal difference between duck and geese. And this is, again, a person that's a maven. He says there's minimal difference between them.
Okay. Now, let me ask you another problem. Are they going to sell these in a raw condition, too, or only pre-cooked?
No. We would never, ever sell any liver that wasn't kashered properly.
So
he's very, very concerned about that.
So let me ask you a question. If you're kashering it, I know that in Israel, where before I knew much about this, I'm going back like 25 years, I once had it, and it was very rare, was sublime. I mean, it's really something for a simcha. It's look, the French, when succumb to Essen, the French zanem evinim, right?
Yeah, right, 100%. If the whole world is crazy about it, you know, there must be something to it.
It's truly something that, you know, look, the Gemara in Baba Basra says that lasid lavay, they're going to serve stuffed geese. That's
right.
What the Gemara of Rabba Babar Khan, I think, is one of the stories. So, so my question is as such, that they serve it rare because it's such a delicacy. And, you know, in Hilchas Melicha, or Dam, it's, I guess, Semen Ayin Gimel, the Sif Seidas, the Prima Gadim in Sif Seidas, says that you have to be makbid to roast it legamre, not like other paiskim, like the Shach and the Taz, who say Chatzi Tzli is good, because of a Shail of Isser Dam. Would the OU be makbid on a Tzli legamre?
100%. And I want to tell you, I spoke today to the Rav at the OU, who we sent down, who has a Messiah how to do this, besides the Rabelski, also, as I said earlier, was involved. And he told me, fascinating, he said he Kamat spent a whole day there. They spent hours and hours. We had given them direction before. But, you know, you can't learn this in a Beis Medrash. This has to be learned halakha lemaisa when you're actually doing it. And it took them almost a whole day until they got it right. And while we were trying to get right is to make sure that the heat in the oven is extremely high. The heat in the oven is extremely high. The heat of the liver gets extremely hot, and it has to remain in that oven for quite a while. There's also an issue because it's not something that you could standardize, because no two livers are the exact same size. So a bigger liver takes more time to roast and get what we feel is a proper kashering than a smaller liver. And we've worked very diligently and continue to work very, very diligently to make sure that it's kashered properly. It's a very serious tension, the point that you make, because the mevinim, the chefs, certainly don't want it roasted and dried out. You lose the chivas that you mentioned earlier.
I mean, it's a das. I want to be honest with you. The Prima Gadim and the Sif Seidas is a das yachid.
But we're being very, very makbid on the tzliya, that it should be done in a very serious way, even though I could tell you that I already heard that the chefs who have been tasting it are sort of disappointed.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Now, let
me ask you one last question. By the way, I want to go back to Chalav Yisrael. I think that there's a material difference between this and Chalav Yisrael, because Chalav Yisrael, according to the Pashtus of a Gemara, when there's no Eda that doesn't have tray for animals, if you're in a place where they don't milk camels, the Pashtus of a Gemara and the Pri Chadash says, you b'chval don't need. There's a Chiddush of the Chsam Sefer where he learns that after the Gemara made the Gzeira, even if you find an Eder that has nothing in it, and on top of that, you have Rav Moshe who says, even according to the Chumra of the Chsam Sefer, it's still Mutter. So you're talking about Das Yachid, the Chsam Sefer, to be Machbid, even though a lot of the world is Machbid on that. And you have Rav Moshe who says, even Lording the Chsam Sefer, because people are Mirsis, you do have a Shmira today. So you're talking sort of like a Chumra of a Chumra, whereas this is, I'll tell you a funny story, Rabbi Elvin, and I'm probably going to get criticized like this, but they already called me names. They'll add this on to it. A guy called... a guy wrote me, called me actually, left a, I don't remember, it was a voicemail or an email, and I spoke to him. He said that he's very makbid on, he only uses hadars or ungers, etc. And his in-laws are not makbid. So he says they live in Borough Park, and he was by them Shabbos, and they didn't have ungers, and he got very upset. So he went home. His mother-in-law said, so bring ungers. He went home. He brought ungers to them, and because he didn't want to eat OU. and she made the salad with the Unger's beets. And so Shiloh was, whose chumris does she have to be makbar on his chumris? Not to eat OU and just eat Unger's. So I asked this guy, wait, let me get this story straight. You carried it on Shabbos? He said, yeah, he uses the Erev. I said, Reb Moshe holds, when you carry in Borough Park on Shabbos, you chayiv skila. I said, you went back on every Dalet Amis, you chayiv skila, because you were makbid not to use Hadar's Hechshen at the OU? I mean, is this the most absurd thing you ever heard in your life?
It's absolutely absurd, and I'll tell you why. It's even more absurd than what you said, and I completely agree with you. It's absurd because probably the Hadar mayonnaise or whatever you're talking about was made in an OU factory.
Okay, so my point is, I think there's a very big difference between Chol of Yisrael and something that, according to many Paiskim, I mean, the Lashonis of some of the Achronim is Hareza Issen Avilas. I just want to just say that I don't agree with that juxtaposition.
We don't have to agree, but using your line of reasoning, and here at the table sort of turn, if you come from a place that follows Menhagik some cipher, so now you're going to use this Chol of Stam product. And again, like you said, there's Reb Moshe, and there's the Pre-Chadosh, et cetera, et cetera. So don't you have to follow the Chassam Sofer because you come from there? And if I would follow your line of reasoning, don't IDOU have to notify that anybody who came from Pressburg should never buy a Hershey bar?
Yeah, I understand that. Again,
I'm using your line of reading.
Yeah, and I would just, again, differentiate that something
well,
that Chol of Yisrael is something that most people
fabulous.
Know. Or
you know, and I have to agree, and I'll make one more point. You know, we at the OU, if we were running our department, like we ran a business, so we spent so much time and so much effort on shechita of meat and poultry, and now we have such a product. And in terms of what we do, I wouldn't say it's 1% of what we do in terms of products certified. If I would talk about the amount of time and effort and people, I would say it's at least 10%, if not more. So you're a businessman. Which business spends 10% of its time and resources on 1% of its income? The answer is because whenever you're dealing with meat, you're dealing with novellas and trephas and numerous derisas. And a cookie, you're not going to have those shilas. So the point is, you're 100% right. There's no shila that Nevelis and Trefis and Dam are much more of a shila, and Tzar Bal Chaim are much more of a shila than Chol of Stam.
Rabbi Elephant, I thank you for your time. I think what you're doing is, I think what the OU is, all of Klal Yisrael needs Hakaras HaTayv to you. And, you know, without you, we wouldn't have hands and feet, literally. I mean, wherever I go. So thank you very much, and it was an honor to have you on with us.
Thank you for having me.
Talta, bye-bye. We have on the phone with us from Oakland, California, Paul Shapiro, who is the vice president at the Humane Society of the United States, the largest animal welfare organization in the world. Welcome, Mr. Shapiro.
David, what an honor to be here. There is a Mr. Shapiro, that's my father, but you can just call me Paul.
Okay, Paul. So, question. I had on a leader of an organization, a food certification organization, who said that veal today is brought up in a humane way. They're not kept in their boxes anymore. They free range, and that it's been mostly the veal society, whatever that means, has basically changed the way because of all the protests, the way, and they are actually brought up in a humane fashion today. As somebody who hasn't been in a farm in, I can't tell you how many decades, can you tell me, is this true or not, just somebody with boots on the ground?
Well, that's really kind of you, David, and I'll tell you, first and foremost, you know, it's hard for many people even to hear the word veal without conjuring up images of animal cruelty. And people think about these calves who for decades were kept in tiny crates where they're unable even to turn around for their whole lives. Some people find the consumption of veal objectionable simply because these are baby animals. But other people find it objectionable because they are immobilized for their whole lives. Today, most of the veal industry has stopped confining the animals in tiny cages, primarily because both laws have been passed to ban that type of inhumanity toward animals and because many retailers have told their suppliers they won't sell their veal if they are doing that anymore. That does not mean, though, that the calves are raised humanely. They certainly are no longer immobilized to the point where they can't move their whole lives, but most of them are still pretty cramped. They're raised in stalls where they may have another calf in there with them, but they don't go outside. They probably don't see sunlight, and they are not leading the type of bucolic life you would imagine a calf on a farm would live. So in short, they have better lives than they did in the past, but I still think many people would say it was a far cry from being actually humane.
When you say they don't see sunlight, they don't see sunlight their entire lives?
Maybe on the back of a truck to a slaughter plant they would, but for the months that they are kept alive prior to slaughter, these calves are typically kept indoors at all times.
Now, Paul, let's talk about foie gras. I know in California it's illegal. Now, how humane, how foie gras, like stuffed geese, how, describe to me, how are they brought up, how are they raised, how are they force-fed, and why in California is it considered inhumane?
Sure. Well, it's both California and a dozen nations around the world, including Israel, where the Supreme Court ruled that the production of foie gras is so inhumane that it violates the country's anti-cruelty statute. So there's a lot of people who have concern about this because, in effect, the way that foie gras, which is French for fatty liver, is produced is that they take a duck or a goose and they shove a pipe down his throat, and they force him to consume much more food than he would ever naturally consume on his own, which causes the bird's liver to swell up to 10 times its normal size. The bird's mortality rates go through the roof. Many of them have difficulty even walking. And they're basically inducing a state of disease that is known as hepatic lipidosis, where the birds have this diseased liver. It's called fatty liver. And in effect, the suffering of the birds is so great that many people just consider it too inhumane for any compassionate person to support. That's why California banned the sale of it. That's why Israel banned the production of it. And the last pope, when he was Cardinal Ratzinger, also condemned it, saying that this was a violation of the mutuality that comes across in the Bible when it comes to the obligation that we have to treat animals humanely.
So I read the animal cruelty law that was, I believe, passed in 1966, and I think according to Wikipedia, at least, which is where I get all my information from, by the way, there has not been another federal law passed. Now, am I reading it correctly when it says that the animal cruelty laws are suspended or do not apply to either mice or rats for laboratory purposes, and all farm animals, which the way I'm reading it, it says that the FDA does not, or the USDA, excuse me, I had the wrong alphabet, the USDA legally does not have a right to opine on the way farm animals are brought up. And I believe this was the basis of why the California was sued by the foie gras raisers, basically saying you have no jurisdiction over farm animals. Am I reading that correctly?
Pretty much, yeah, David. In short, the federal laws have absolutely no bearing on the way that farm animals are treated on the farm. There are some laws that relate to the treatment of animals while they're inside of a slaughter plant, but that's, of course, for the final moments of their lives. But for the treatment of these animals, for the 99% of their lives that they're on farms, there's no federal protection for them. Yet what is really interesting about this is that really some of the first ever animal protection laws that were ever set down are in the Torah, and they are farm animal protection laws. Laws, for example, that prohibit you from yoking animals of a different species together because the stronger one would outcompete the weaker one and make it hard for him to, for example, thresh the field. Other laws saying that you can't work your oxen and muzzle them at the same time because it's too psychologically frustrating for them to be in the midst of all of this food and not able to eat it. And so you look at some of the original laws relating to humanity's proper treatment of animals, and what you find is that the Torah actually established some of the most important laws of that era for the humane treatment of farm animals. And today we have a situation where the actual treatment of farm animals is so far more inhumane than, for example, muzzling an ox while he is threshing a field.
Oxum sharbadisha or Clium, both of them. And additionally, there are a number of other laws. For example, there's a law that if you see your enemy's animal, ox, struggling under a load, right, you have to help him to lift the load off the animal, either to load it or unload it. And it says an enemy's ox comes before a friend's ox, almost to impart the power of the. You see how the Torah is so careful about animal cruelty.
Animal.
I'll give you a few other examples. Under certain situations, allowed to milk an animal, a cow on the Shabbat, so it should not have distress. You're not allowed to slaughter a mother and a child at the same day. You can't kill an ox and its calf the same day, or rather a cow and its calf the same day. And there are numerous others where you see that the Torah was really at the forefront of the world when it came to animal cruelty.
That's exactly right, and it's including not just physical pain that we may cause to animals, but even psychological distress. For example, we are urged, if we're going to take eggs from a bird's nest, to shoo
correct
the mother away.
According to Maimonides, that's the case. Not to cause
right
distress. That's correct again. I see you're a biblical scholar, Paul.
David, I'm far from a scholar, but it is a great passion and interest of mine. And the point being driven home is this. Whether you're looking at the Torah, or whether you're looking at scholars like Maimonides, or whether you're looking at the Talmud, for example, with this essentially Jewish conception of Tzar Belech Hayim, or avoiding the causing the suffering of animals, Jews have been at the forefront of animal protection theory and action for millennia. And that's why in the animal protection movement today, you see such a disproportionate number of us throughout the animal movement. You know, we're a tiny percentage of America, and yet we're a substantially, disproportionately larger percentage of the animal welfare movement, both in America and around the world. And I don't think it's an accident.
So, Paul, if a consumer is to say, listen, when it comes to animal cruelty, I rely on the USDA, how would you respond to that?
Well, it's very easy to be an expert on USDA protections for animals on farms because there are none. And so relying on them essentially means that you're relying on literally no rules at all. The USDA has no authority to ensure the on-farm treatment of animals. And so USDA does all types of important things in other areas. But when it comes to the treatment of animals on farms, there's no authority that the agency has. And so you really cannot rely on the agency because they've never been asked to do anything on the topic by Congress.
Well, thank you very much, Paul, and good luck with all your work.
David, that's very kind of you. Thank you so much.
I have on the phone with us Naftali Hanau, who runs a meat. Well, how do I describe meat? Let me do this again. How would I describe it?
We're a meat purveyor.
A meat purveyor. Okay, let me do this again. We have on the phone with us Naftali Hanau, who runs a meat purveyor called Grow and Behold. Welcome, Naftali.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Naftali, could you describe to our audience briefly what you do?
So what I do is I run a business called Grow and Behold Foods. We sell the best kosher meat around. Our meats are raised on pasture with no antibiotics, no hormones. They're raised outdoors where they have room to express their natural behaviors, to run around, eat the diet that they're meant to eat. We pay special attention to how the animals are treated, how our workers are treated, how the slaughterhouse workers are treated, every step along the chain to produce the most delicious kosher meat on the market.
And what inspired you to do this?
So I have been a carnivore my whole life. I grew up in Rochester, New York, around the corner from the kosher butcher. I was the kid who used to get off the bus and stop early to go into the butcher shop and get cold cuts and whatever it was, charged it to my mother's account. At this point, I guess it's now 10 years ago, I was in Connecticut at the Isabella Friedman Jewish Retreat Center doing a program called Adama, which is a Jewish farming and environmental leadership program. And that's where I started to learn about some of the environmental issues, some of the animal welfare issues, and some of the, you know, the problems, at least the way I see it, with kind of conventional animal husbandry and meat production in the industrialized world. But for me, as somebody who always, you know, grew up eating kosher food and who was also not interested in being a vegetarian, there really weren't too many options. Now, I actually had run a landscaping business when I was in high school and college, and was planning to go into kind of the green industry, so maybe a plant nursery or a landscaping firm or design. And when I was working at Adama, I realized that what I really loved to do was to feed people. So I met the woman, Anna, who's now my wife there, and we had thought we were going to move back to Rochester and have a vegetable farm. So we're going to be in Rochester. We're going to have a farm, so we'll raise chickens. So what should I do? Obviously, I should learn shtetl so that I can check their chickens. So what are you going to do? You're going to fly a shelf head in from New York to check your chickens? That seems silly. In fact, it's not so simple to learn shtetl, but I did. And we, as we were finding that it was, it's not so practical to be a farmer in America and also walk to shul and send your kids to day school. Through learning shtetl, I had learned shtetl for poultry, and as soon as I finished and got my Kabbalah, my license to chef poultry, my Rebbe sent me a big knife in the mail and said, okay, new, keep going. And I never actually learned shtetl for large animals, but I did learn the nikor, the deveining. I worked in butcher shops, slaughterhouses kind of around the country. And as we were realizing that maybe farming was not the right path for us, we also saw that, you know, I knew how to take a cow and make a kosher steak. And that is not a simple process. And it was really, at the time, nobody who was really doing this and doing a good job of it to kind of fit the standards that we wanted to see. And I was working on farms during this time, and I was surrounded by all these delicious-looking animals that were happy. They're raised on pasture. They're raised at a human scale. But they weren't kosher. I couldn't eat them. So,
do you raise veal?
We do. What we sell is rose veal. It is not the veal that most people are used to. Our veal calves are almost a year old. They're raised with the mother. They're naturally weaned on pasture. When they're like 6 to 9 months old, they wean themselves. And they hang out on a nice pasture for another couple of months until they.
And how are they different than regular veal?
So regular veal is separated from the mother at birth. They're either milk fed or formula, you know, fed. Very pale and very white. Our veal are raised outdoors on pasture. They eat grass, and they and their meat is a more red and rose color, which is why it's called rose veal.
I mean, it's because it's not formula fed.
It is not formula fed. No, they're raised with the mother.
I guess all the veal that is formula fed, I guess according to Ramesha Feinstein, should not be eaten, he said, by Yirei Shemayim, Shomer Nafshoi, because he says it's unnatural and it pains the animal. So you, in effect, do not have any white veal. That's what.
No, we don't sell white veal. We sell rose veal. We're not interested in selling that kind of veal.
Now, have you ever considered raising foie gras?
No, it is not something that we have been able to do humanely in the States.
Is it possible to raise foie gras in a humane level, in your opinion?
You know, I'm not an expert on that, so I can't say. There are people who claim they can do it and who are trying to do it, but, you know, I am not an expert in foie gras.
Have you ever seen the way veal, in the vast majority of operations, are raised, the conditions in which they're raised?
Yeah.
And would you consider that sarba lechayim?
I don't like to poo-poo what other people do and what other people eat. That's not my place. What I do is what I do. I don't buy white veal myself. You know? But, you know, have I been to a wedding with a good hashgacha? where there's veal at the buffet, yes. And it's not for me to say something is or isn't kosher. That I leave to the hashgachas and the rebbeim.
Hello, it's clearly kosher. There's no shiloh.
You know,
it's a question of whether there's a shiloh of are you eating something that was raised on the Tzav Lachaim. There's no shiloh. We're not talking about that. Well, Ramesha talks about the issues of kashrus, but he says many of them are bali mum. But we're not talking about that element. We're just talking about the Tzav Lachaim element. Can I ask you a question, Apolli? How does the pricing of your animal, of your meat, compare to traditional pricing of a standard, Empire chicken or a standard, Lubashkin, whatever the name of the meat you buy is?
Our meat is, it depends on what you're comparing our meat to. So if you're comparing our meat to whatever is in your kosher supermarket, on Avenue M, our meat can be twice as expensive. If you're comparing you can't compare our meat to that meat because it is a totally different product. The quality is totally different, the taste is totally different, the way it's produced and raised and packaged, all of it is different. If you compare our meat to the prices in, the fancy kosher butcher shops or fancy non-kosher butcher shops even, our meat is not particularly more expensive. It can be comparable. Maybe it's 10 or 15% more expensive. I mean, it really just depends on where you shop and what you're buying. But I think what's really the most telling is if you compare the prices of our meat to what I'd say is the most equivalent meat in the non-kosher market. Because you can't take, the chicken that I'm selling that's raised outdoors on pasture and move to fresh grass every day and compare it to, the supermarket chicken that's raised in a barn with 50,000 other chickens. It just it's a different product. So if you compare our meat to what you would find at a farmer's market or in a high-end non-kosher butcher shop where they're also selling meats that are raised outdoors and pasture-raised, et cetera, our prices are actually quite similar. I was looking, actually, I'm on the email list for, there's a company called Fleischer's, and it's non-kosher. Of course, their grandfathers, or great-grandfathers were kosher butchers long ago. They no longer, in fact, the Fleischer's sold the business a few years ago. Anyway, but they sell grass-fed, organic, pastured meat, et cetera. And how much are their turkeys? They're $7.99 a pound for pasture-raised turkeys. How much are my kosher pasture-raised turkeys? They're also $7.99. So when I see that, I'm actually quite proud because generally kosher meat is about twice the price of non-kosher meat because kosher meat is twice the work. We have to soak it. We have to salt it. We have to devein it. We have to defeather it. All of this stuff actually takes a lot of work. It must be done under hashgacha. All of that stuff costs money. But we, in fact, are able to keep our prices, relatively competitive to, a similarly produced non-kosher product.
So are you based in Rochester?
That's where we formed the business, and that's where I grew up. We actually live in Brooklyn, and our animals are raised mostly in Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia.
Uh-huh. Well, Naftali, thank you very much, and if somebody wants to find you, where would they go to the
You
the
can
web?
Go to growandbehold.com. We sell our products online, or you can give us a call. It's www.growandbehold.com.
And
all
who is the master?
Our red meats are under the star K, and we also have Beit Yosef meat, which is under the star S, which is the star K's Beit Yosef Hashgacha. And our poultry is under the OU.
Naftali, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
We have on the phone with us Rabbi David Nagar Power. He's a Rebbe in South Shore. He's a member of the Katz Kollel, and he's written about vegetarianism and halacha. Welcome, Rabbi Nagar Power. Rabbi David, I'll call you Rabbi David, okay?
Really,
could you tell me, you've researched vegetarianism and halacha. Could you tell me some of your findings?
Well, first was mostly my hashgafic sort of look. I sort of saw Rav Albo, Seferi Karim, then I saw Rav Cook, and then one of the things I just saw missing, for quite obvious reasons, more of just a happy accident, was the Rav, because his book, or at least published manuscripts that was turned into a book, wasn't published until 2005. And no one until when I wrote it, I think it was 2017, I wrote the article. No one from 2005, 2012 really wrote anything about the issue. So I thought it would be at least better to sort of discuss the previously known opinions and then talk about the Rav's opinion, Rav's Soloveitchik's opinion. My starting point really for the sort of discussion was sort of Rav Bleich's article on vegetarianism in Contemporary Halakha. His articles are fantastic and I loved them in high school. And as a result of it, I sort of wanted to sort of talk about it, but sort of add to the conversation by talking about the Rav's position. So the Rav was a little more sympathetic to vegetarians, and is, as my article sort of goes into detail, he's a very sort of, I want to say, I guess, gory language for, you know, or very, very, very strong language for those who eat meat. I don't necessarily think he was a vegetarian, but I do think that he at least saw it as a at least reasonable ethical norm. But that's just not what I found. And in discussing the issue, I made sure to end off the article with some halachic sort of discussion, one of which was Hilchot Shabbat, you know, whether or not there's going to be an issue with them eating meat on Shabbat, because obviously they won't eat meat, and yet there may be a chiyuv to eat meat. And I discussed, the Magen Avraham says that it's not necessarily a chiyuv after the Korban Bayit to eat meat on Shabbat. And the other issue, which was introduced to me by one of my rabbis from high school, Rabbi Howard Jachter, was the issue of gerus, that if a ger comes and that person, he or she is a vegetarian, can we megayer that person? What kind of questions do we have to ask? And one of the footnotes I linked to the article where he discusses how if the person says that I won't be megayer, even if the Beit HaMikdash comes and the Kavanas come back, I still won't eat the Kodshim. So we won't megayer the person because he or she refuses to eat the Kodshim. And then I sort of make a comment about how, at least if anything, it seems a little odd to say that, even though that is the BDA is a position, and, you know, I respect the BDA tremendously, just a sort of a thought and a question, really, I left the reader with, about how, you know, logically, a person can mekayem a mitzvah even if the mitzvah is not, you know, on him, basically. Like, logically, it would make sense. You can say that, you know, I tacitly keep the rule of, you know, always eating lunch at, 12:61, which isn't the time at all, because that time doesn't exist. And I always eat at that time because, you know, that's just vacuous. It's just meaningless, really, to say that. So today, we don't have the Beit HaMikdash. So the person, in essence, really agrees to it because there's no chiv on him at the moment. But that was more of a logical point, not necessarily a halachic point. It really was sort of just to introduce the readers to sort of at least have a discussion. And if anyone had really a thought, I was really interested in hearing it.
Well, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it. And we're going to put the article up on our website. All the best.